C-158. Number 4A.
South, we take the chapter on Atonement and Eucharist and just want to have a bird's eye view on the main points in it. To atone is defined as to be or cause to be at one. To be or cause to be at one, to agree, to accord, to harmonize. One can see at once that it's a step further that comes after prayer. See, prayer sets the picture, so to say. And now Atonement and Eucharist gets the move into that picture. It sets the picture in prayer, because in prayer it says prayer cannot change the signs of being, but it tends to bring us into harmony with it. It just gives the necessary starting points in order that one can be in harmony with God. And so Atonement comes and strengthens now that tendency and binds us stronger and stronger to God. It's Atonement and Eucharist. Eucharist is a term from the Greek meaning oikerios, well rejoicing, a well rejoicing. So it is an atonement to become one with well rejoicing, with a happy feeling of that oneness of God and man. But that happy rejoicing, that comes through a process of the cup which Jesus asked disciples to drink. It comes through the cup which gives the crown. And so in Jesus' time, Mrs. Eddy says that the disciples' Eucharist were the cup which shows forth the bitter experience, the human yielding to the divine. That is a disciple's cup, a disciple's Eucharist, a disciple's Eucharist. But the moment she speaks of the Christian signs, communion, the Christian scientist's Eucharist, then it is the spiritual communion with the one God. So you see, we have to see the stages of the Eucharist so that we don't mix the categories again. In one sense, it is the bitter experience as shown forth by Jesus already. It is that bitter experience which comes about because the human has to yield to the divine. But on the plane of science, because science does not know human factors, on the plane of science, the human has yielded to the divine, and then the Eucharist is just a spiritual communion with the one God. So that really atonement in its highest sense and Eucharist in its highest sense just say more or less the same, namely the unity of God and man. But showing the way to that unity, that's always the point we have to see. You see, we can never take the end for the beginning. And so we can never take a definition of a subject which comes at the end of a chapter as the only definition. There is always a way to the climax definition. The climax definition of the Eucharist is the Christian Science Eucharist as the communion with the one God. But before that are pages and pages and pages showing the way to that spiritual communion, which is by laying down the human sense for the divine sense. So it's always the cup and the cross that becomes finally a crown, and we see that there is no crown without a cross, without wearing and carrying the cross. In prayer already she says there is a cross to be taken up before we can enjoy the fruition of our hope and faith. She shows now that in order to have the full fruition of prayer, we have to fulfill Atonement and Eucharist. That there is no fulfillment of prayer without going further to the standpoint of Atonement and Eucharist, namely, to the standpoint of that willingness to lay down the human and material and mortal sense of life. Because she shows that not both will earn heaven, the human and the divine. No duality will earn harmony. That we only can enter into the holy city by leaving out everything that is not of the nature of the holy city. That's what Atonement and Eucharist is going to tell us, namely the demand that comes up, which says, your prayers will be more and more fulfilled in the measure as prayer is coupled with Atonement and Eucharist. There is a cross to be taken up before what she says we can enjoy the fruition of our hope and faith. What is that Atonement and Eucharist trying to teach us? First, I think we have to see that opposites cannot be reconciled, cannot be atoned. That's very important. See, we have gone out and have looked at the chapter on prayer from the standpoint of the oneness of being, where we have seen there is only one nature, the divine nature. And therefore the petitioner and the petitioned and the means of petition and the results of the petition must be of the one nature. And therefore the logic of it is that only that which is of the one nature can be one. Consequently, that everything which is not of this one nature cannot be reconciled with God, must be laid down, cannot be reconciled with God. We cannot atone two opposite natures, that we cannot atone two irreconcilable natures, that we cannot, that even Christ, she says, cannot atone truth to error. That we cannot atone a nature which is not already of the same nature of God. Well, these are so simple statements, so completely simple and obvious statements, that they really need to be considered and not to be put away as too simple and too obvious. You see, Einstein, I read recently a biography on a history on Einstein, and he was asked why, I can't say it exactly in the same words, but in a talk like this I don't think it doesn't matter, and I have read it in German, but he was asked why he feels that he was able to discover what he has discovered, theory of relativity and so on. And they ask him what he really feels his genius is, what has enabled him to get this result. And he said, because I'm very slow in thinking. He said, most people are so quick in their younger years that they just can accept everything which is presented to them. And he said, I'm so slow in thinking and in accepting things that I have to think things over 100,000 times. And he said, because I have thought over the most obvious and most simple statements which everybody just on the first hit accepts, because I had to think them over and over and over, I find out that they were not true. He said, then I found out that everybody accepts, he says, as a youngster or as a young, as a child, accept that there is absolute time and absolute space. That there is time and that there is space. Who doesn't accept that as a child? He said, I couldn't accept it, so I had to think it over and found out that there isn't. That there is no time and no space. You see? So the genius of him was that he was very slow in thinking and just couldn't accept the obvious as obvious. If we would do that in science, we would get somewhere. If we would accept such statements as we are considering today and tomorrow, they are always so simple and so obvious that the human mind is ready to say, yes, we know that now. Tell us something really good. If it should be the best talk ever, tell us something really good. But if we really can consider such things and reconsider them and think them over 100 times, 200 times, what does that mean that Mrs. Eddy makes such an obvious statement that even Christ could not reconcile truth to error, that opposite natures are irreconcilable? If you would think that over 100 times and 1,000 times, always afresh, always new, not repetitive, but always with an investigating mind, always with a prayerful mind, we would find out that our whole life is impregnated through and through with a sense that one can reconcile opposites. That one can reconcile God with a mortal and a mortal with God. That one can do that. That God can reconcile and can justify all our funny ways of thinking and affections on, that it can reconcile with heaven. We can't. If we would really, really properly ponder, pray over it, not meditate, pray over it, because we have a definite subject, that truth and error are forever and ever irreconcilable, then we wouldn't try to reconcile error with truth. We wouldn't try to reconcile sickness with health. We wouldn't try it. We wouldn't try to reconcile lack with fullness. We wouldn't try to reconcile a sense of lack of provision and a lack of provision. You don't say provision. Well, any supply, lack of supply with fullness of supply. We just wouldn't. But inwardly, if we analyze it down to the bones, we try to do that in science. We try somehow to reconcile sickness with health, lack with fullness. Whereas, she says, that's not reconcilable. Well, what shall we do then if it's not reconcilable? Shall we go on in lack? No, we can go to prayer. And start with prayer and say, what does prayer say? It says, start with the sense of fullness. That's your starting point, not with a sense of lack. Start with a sense of fullness, and then the atonement says, well, that can always be one with fullness. That can always be atonement. That is always one and is always in harmony with fullness. And if you couple that with the Eucharist of laying down your funny concept that you have lack, and with your very funny view that you are sick and can ever be sick, if you really get rid of that, then you are in health. Then you feel your presence of health, your oneness with health, and so on. Can you see that? It's always in the oneness of being. But let's not reconcile, try to reconcile somehow opposites, opposite natures. It can't be done. Can't be done. So there really is no atonement, you see, without Eucharist. There is no oneness without first the willingness to abandon a false standpoint, to abandon it completely. Now, how are the connections between prayer and atonement and Eucharist? In prayer, I could say prayer stipulates man's unity with God. It only stipulates it. As we have seen, that the petitioner is the image and likeness of God, the true petitioner. It stipulates that fundamentally, right from the beginning, we go out from man's oneness with God. You see, the textbook is not going to show how we can become one, how man can become one with God. It starts right from the beginning, from the point of perfection. It's no working up process. But that unity of man with God is not yet explicitly pronounced as it is, say, in the chapter on science of being. But interwoven into the whole theme is that standpoint already there. That only man in God's own likeness can pray to God effectively.